The nuclear jihadist is the true story of how one man, A.Q. Khan from Pakistan, facilitated the spread of nuclear weapons technology to Pakistan, Iran, North Korea, and Libya, and how the U.S. government knowingly allowed that man to smuggle and deal the most dangerous secrets in the world. The book is written by Douglas Frantz, a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist, formerly with the New York Times, and his wife Catherine Collins, who was reported for the Chicago Tribune, the L.A. Times, and the New York Times. We spoke to them yesterday at their home in Washington and began by going to the beginning of their narrative, that back in 1975, Dutch authorities were passing on to the CIA and European intelligence agencies that Pakistan was buying nuclear equipment, but it did not occur to Western experts and intelligence agents that Pakistan could acquire the technological expertise to enrich uranium.
Perhaps their expectations weren't so unreasonable. They thought at that time that Pakistan was pursuing only a plutonium program, and they didn't start pursuing the uranium enrichment until Khan returned in 1975. The enrichment of uranium, to use uranium as the fissile material for a bomb, is far more difficult, although it's easier to keep it a secret. And Khan did not do this on his own, nor did he do it only with Pakistani infrastructure. In addition to the technology he stole from this lab in Europe, he also took with him a list of suppliers. He was able to develop a black market of sorts and shop around the globe for both the know-how and the equipment that he needed in order to jumpstart his own program in Pakistan. So this Pakistani bomb is not purely Pakistani. It's a little bit British, a little bit French, Swiss, American, Russian. A lot of countries participated, whether or not they knew it. A lot of countries participated in the Pakistani program.
Sure. We're speaking with Catherine Collins and Douglas Frantz, are the authors of the new book, The Nuclear Jihadist. Now, going back, and your book really details this in explicit details, how throughout the Carter-Reagan administrations, halfway into the George H.W. Bush tenure, elements in the U.S. government were determined to acknowledge publicly that Pakistan was building their bomb, they're going towards this nuclear program. And if we did so, of course, then there would be sanctions against them, and that wasn't conducive to other parts of American foreign policy. And it seems like it could remind some of what the U.S. did in terms of tilting towards Iraq and the Iraq-Iran war. In a way, it seemed like we had a blind eye here to help Pakistan get to where they were with their nuclear weapons. Do you think, again, now a much different landscape in 2007, that those lessons have been learned at the CIA, the State Department, other facets of American government?
Well, I fear that those lessons have not been learned. I mean, as you rightly point out, beginning with President Jimmy Carter and going right up through the next three administrations, we willingly turned a blind eye to Pakistan's pursuit of a nuclear weapon and to A.Q. Khan's role, because the United States was far more concerned with using Pakistan as a conduit to provide money and arms to the Afghan resistance that was fighting and ultimately defeating the Soviets in Afghanistan. Now, we have seen exactly that same thing happen since September 11th, as far as the U.S.-Pakistani relationship goes. After September 11th, the Bush administration determined that General Pervez Musharraf, the dictator who runs Pakistan, was a necessary, even vital ally in the so-called war on terrorism. And so they once again turned a blind eye toward what A.Q. Khan was doing at that time, which was selling nuclear technology to Libya and providing it to Iran and also trading it to North Korea for missile technology. One of the most interesting things and surprising things, I think, that we discovered in reporting this book, Mitch, was that in late 1999 or early 2000, the CIA recruited a prominent member of A.Q. Khan's nuclear network to become an asset for them. And from at least 2000 forward, he was providing the United States intelligence services with detailed information about what Khan was doing. And yet, it took until the end of 2003, more than 3 years, for the United States to take definitive action against Khan. And in that time, a lot of toothpaste got squeezed out of the nuclear tube here.
Absolutely. Now, you have evidence in this book that the intelligence was shaped to fit a preordained outcome going back into, I guess it was the late 1980s. This certainly happened to Rich Barlow, who was asked to prepare an analysis of Pakistan's nuclear program to Defense Secretary Dick Cheney back in 1989. If you could tell our listeners, who was Rich Barlow and what ultimately happened to him?
Sure. Rich Barlow was an interesting fellow. He, in 1980, he wrote a thesis at his university, which used open source material, meaning public material, to describe Pakistan's nuclear program. So as early as 1980, the information was available in public about what Pakistan was doing. But again, the United States had closed down that avenue and decided not to go after Pakistan on the nuclear weapon. In the mid-1980s, Barlow went to work for the CIA, and there again, he saw strong evidence and incidents of Pakistan acquiring United States technology and Canadian technology to use in its nuclear program, acquiring it illegally. He tried to blow the whistle at the CIA, and he was forced out of his job. He went to work at the Pentagon. Again, the same issues came up. He was involved in some very important criminal cases, and as we recount in great detail, and I think dramatic detail in the book, he wound up again losing his job because he tried to speak out about what Pakistan was doing at a time when Pakistan was considered a vital American ally in the fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan.